Good evening. This is Life Battle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Battle number 1201, we bring you a Life Battle classic from 1990, written and read by Martha McLaughlin. In tonight's story, Radio Caravan, our narrator struggles with the unstable life that comes with marriage to a radio personality husband, a man whose drinking has toppled him from his position of DJ Supreme at a Toronto radio station during the British invasion, to someone who must move to distant Thunder Bay to find a job. With clear prose that remains cool in highly charged situations, McLaughlin takes us on a journey both geographical and psychological. Through the end of a marriage and the possible beginning of another relationship, we follow the narrator's quest for self-determination and the opportunity to experience being alone. Martha McLaughlin was born in Toronto and lived in Thunder Bay, Sault Ste. Marie, and Duluth, Minnesota, before she returned to Toronto in 1983 and worked to organize co-op housing. We've been out of touch with Martha for almost 20 years, so her Life Rattle bio ends there. Martha, if you're listening, please get in touch with us. Let's listen now to Radio Caravan, written and read by Martha McLaughlin.
I moved to Thunder Bay from Duluth with my 10-year-old daughter, Sarah, and Glenn, also known as the Big G, in 1981. I moved from Toronto to Duluth when the G fell out of employment in 1980. After Duluth, he found employment in Thunder Bay. Glenn worked for the radio station CJLB. The radio station gave us accommodation in the Prince Arthur Hotel. We were big then. We occupied the same suite Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip had during a previous visit. We drove into Thunder Bay the beginning of October, and it was snowing. We drove along Cumberland, a desolate main street, to the radio station, a gray cement block structure. A rainbow-styled sign with the call letters illuminated the station for us. Across the street was a Robin's donut shop and a pizza joint. Later at the hotel, Glenn told me Ray, the station manager, had worked in the news department at the same station in Toronto he was at. That was when he reigned DJ Supreme for 5 years, spinning the British invasion hits. I didn't know him then. I was in my early teens and camping out for Beatle tickets. Apparently the Big G brought the Beatles on stage, but everyone except the Beatles was a blur to me. Ray worked in the news department. He ripped stories from the wire service and made them into readable copy for the announcers. Glenn told me he was a nervous nobody. He was still nervous the day I met him, but he was now hiring the Big G. Ray and the G shook hands and smiled a lot. The G was nervous, but others couldn't tell. They quipped about the old days at CKY, but Ray soon cut it short. He wasn't good at small talk, or any talk, really. He gave us a tour of the station and introduced us to the music director, Bob Carr. Bob had a glass eye. While he talked to Glenn about the music format, Sarah kept her eyes on Bob's eye. I put my arm around her and pulled her closer to me. As we passed the newsroom, Ray introduced us to Sam. He was tubby, with premature gray hair and a pale complexion. He gave us an enthusiastic hello and said Sarah looked just like her dad. The G was dark-eyed and haired with olive-colored skin. Sarah and I are both fair, blonde, and blue-eyed. I didn't know if Sam was looking for an admission that the G wasn't her father, or if he just said those stupid things. I found out the latter was true. Before we left, Ray introduced us to Harry, the corpulent sales manager, who regaled us with a few dirty jokes. Harry was the one who had us upped to the royal suite. Ray was the practical sort who saw to it we had adequate accommodations. Harry was the high roller. He was determined to shake Thunder Bay. He called the hotel to check our accommodations and demanded a suite for us. While Glenn wasn't on the rise anymore, they were happy to have someone of his caliber join the staff. They expected to get ratings with the Big G. We spent the afternoon getting settled. The hotel was located at the main intersection of Thunder Bay. At dinner time, we went looking for a place to eat. Sarah wanted Chinese food. Harry, the sales manager, took us out to dinner the night before Glenn went on the air. He and the G pumped themselves up, both having a background in Toronto radio. The stories were quite entertaining. No mention was made why they were working in Thunder Bay. The evening ended early, and we went back to our suite. It had two entrances from the hall. The hotel had joined two rooms to create a suite for the Queen. We were in good humor and went in separate doors. Sarah was watching television. I put her to bed and got myself ready. When I went back to the living room, the G was having a drink. I kept him company for a while and then went to bed. When we woke up, he was curled on a couch. I woke him up and implored him to be on time. First day of the new job. I drove back to Duluth to pack and wait for North American van lines. I tuned into the station and caught the 10 o'clock newscast with Sam as I drove out of town. When Glenn opened the mic to speak, I knew he was still drunk. I hoped no one else would notice and kept driving till I lost the station. In Duluth, I phoned Glenn at the radio station. They told me he had gone back to the hotel. I feared he had lost the job already. He was in good spirits when I reached him at the hotel. Good sign, the job was still intact. Sam, the news announcer, complained to Ray that Glenn had screwed up the order of the news story cartridges. The manager told Glenn to take the rest of the day off and would meet with him the next day. Glenn was livid that this tinhead without an ounce of talent in this asshole town would turn him in. Glenn was never contrite where drinking was involved. Over the next few months, Sam became a fan of Glenn's. It was true Sam didn't have talent. He knew it but persevered. He loved radio and he loved Glenn, who had attained star status in Sam's eyes. He always worked late on nights the G was there. Now, more often than days, after the first day on the air episode, Sam kept himself busy putting the news stories together and laughing at everything the G said, both on and off the air. The G still thought Sam was a Judas, but was not immune to flattery. Sam wasn't close to anyone at CJLB. He worked a lot and ate a lot. The few times I saw his wife and kids, I was horrified at how he treated them. His attitude was that his wife should stay home always and look after his kids. Whenever she dropped by the station, Sam shooed her out immediately. The rare time they had a babysitter for the kids, Sam insisted they go home by 9 o'clock. I never knew if it was the money or that his wife was enjoying herself. At staff parties, he came alone, ate, and left. A few years later, Sam and his family moved to Barrie. He was determined to work in a major market, and he saw Barrie as a step into Toronto. The job in Barrie didn't work out as planned. No one of importance from Toronto heard him and offered him a job at Chum. Sam said the news director in Barrie was a jerk and didn't like him because he was Jewish. Sam was always bossy and abrasive. He was fired. The marriage didn't work out either. His wife took the kids and moved back to Sault Ste. Marie, where they originally met. Cheryl had wearied of the radio caravan. She lived in 8 different cities during her 6-year marriage. Barrie was her last stop. Sam moved back to Thunder Bay a lonely and bitter man. He took to dropping over to our house to visit with the Big G. He always called Glenn by his radio name. Glenn told him stories about life in the big times. Sam couldn't hear enough about Toronto and New York. The G worked there for a week before he met up with a German playboy bunny and drove off to Hollywood. Sam was in news, but he never questioned why Glenn was in Thunder Bay after such an illustrious start. When the laughing ceased, I lent an ear to the divorce proceedings. It was going to be an expensive fight. Sam wanted good access to his kids. He was emphatic about that. He wanted Cheryl to sign a cash settlement of $10,000 and from there to negotiate support payments for the children. The fight cost him $16,000 in lawyer's fees, but he got his way. He never understood why his wife left him. I gave her everything. She had nothing before she met me. You should see the dump she grew up in. I took her on trips. She can't afford to go anywhere now. Hell, she's working part-time in a Dairy Queen in the Sioux now. I spent hours explaining to Sam why his wife had left him. He couldn't comprehend that she wasn't his chattel, raised to be a caregiver for him and his kids. I told him she was lonely. She spent all her time with her two preschool children or cooking meals for him. Her mind was drying up. Sam interrupted me and repeated his wife's faults. She was stupid. She didn't know when she had it good. She came from nothing and went back to nothing. If it weren't for him, she'd never have left Sault Ste. Marie. The discussion always ended on a sour note, and he went home lonely and bitter. By 1985, I was having difficulty finding reason to stay with Glenn. I loved him and was destroying myself because of it. I was weary of the mirth and merriment. I needed some substance in my life. Radio personalities tend to be on air 24 hours a day. They talk to a lot of people in a vacuum. The audience at home is not expected to speak out of turn, out of sequence, or out of the established mood. My friend Karen's wedding precipitated my leaving. Glenn worked during the day, but came to the reception with me in the evening. I'm usually pretty cynical about weddings, but this was the second one I'd attended in Thunder Bay. Both times, it was friends I'd made in Thunder Bay. I watched their relationships grow while mine stagnated. Glenn spent the whole evening at the bar. We knew everyone there, so I mingled. I sat with Tish for about an hour. A year ago, when Sam had just come back from Barrie, we had attended Tish's wedding. After her quiet reception, a group of us went to the lounge at the Prince Arthur Hotel for a drink. The Big G interviewed Sam. The rest of us listened as Sam responded to the questions and told how he was raised in a protective environment in Hamilton by his mother. The G asked where his father was. Sam replied that his father died when Sam was 12. The orphan aspect intrigued the G, and he further questioned Sam on how his father died. The G had a way of directing questions in a sincere fashion, that he was interested in you and your answers. I had long ago realized that any information obtained was used to find weakness and could be used when he was drinking. Sam was on the seat, though, and he told us how his father died on the Burlington Skyway. The G jumped at this one. "Died on the Skyway?" "Yes," Sam said. "He was driving on it, and he had a heart attack. When asked if he was found in the car, he said no." With further questioning, he revealed that the car was found on the bridge, but his father floated ashore in the States about a month later. The G pounced. "Your father didn't have a heart attack. He jumped, Sam," he screamed. Sam tried to mention the story he grew up with, but the G kept repeating he jumped. We were all in stitches. Sam composed himself and admitted his father probably did commit suicide, but his mother told him otherwise. With that admission, Sam revealed that Dad left a successful business behind, and Sam's income was supplemented with money from the trust his protective mother had set up. It was Karen's reception this time, and Tish had time to socialize. She asked me why I stayed in Thunder Bay. While we talked, I could see Glenn holding court at the bar. I couldn't give her a good reason. Just before 1 o'clock, I saw him moving over to the father of the bride's table. To anybody else, it seemed like a move to socialize, but I knew better. He was lining up another place to drink afterwards. Karen was used to the G's all-night marathons and indicated to Glenn that it was time for the guests to go home. In the car, Glenn told me he'd gone to New York with Patty while he was in Toronto. He had a month to tell me, but he chose this particular night. It was the first time I didn't feel anything. I had the information, but no reaction. He could have told me he saw a blue card today and got the same response. He wanted me to feel insecure, threatened. This time I didn't. He was used to having someone on the back burner, and after 7 years, I was exhausted from it all. On Sunday, he was working another afternoon shift. I wandered from room to room in the house. I felt empty. I felt stupid. I was living in Thunder Bay because he couldn't find a job anywhere else. I let him tell people we were there because it was a better environment for Sarah to be raised. I let him save face. I mean, it wasn't all bad living there, but I was living a lie. I didn't want to leave Toronto. I was there for Glenn. And he was still playing these stupid games. I decided that I'd had enough. I wanted out. I found Sarah in the living room. She was now 14. I told her how I was feeling and asked her if she'd mind moving back to Toronto. She moved closer to me and put her arms around me. She told me she had wanted to leave for a long time. I explained I couldn't tell Glenn we were moving. I didn't trust how he would react, and I didn't want him to try and change my mind. We talked about where we'd live. I told her it would be difficult at first. She said she understood and would try to help. I tallied up my funds, including my income tax return. I wanted to use it for a holiday, but Glenn kept saying it wasn't worth going anywhere. Once I made the decision, everything went on automatic pilot. I called North American Van Lines on the Monday and arranged for the agent to come to the house while Glenn was working. I didn't have an address to move my stuff to, so it was just a matter of getting it picked up and put in storage for the time being. The hard part was telling the guy that I was moving in a rather deceptive fashion. He didn't raise an eyebrow. He offered to bring the boxes on the Saturday when they picked the stuff up. That week I organized all the cupboards and closet space. Everything I was taking would be easy to pack. Big G didn't notice any change in me. He stopped paying attention to me a long time ago. Inside, I was pleading for him to notice me, to love me, to give me a reason to stay. But it was the same BS. He'd bring home his beer every night. Sam would show up to be entertained. He didn't need my company. He was still trying to get a reaction from his New York trip. I was completely rational about it. The night before we moved, Sarah wanted a girlfriend to spend the night. She needed a confidant. She chose Kirsten, the daughter of a policeman. He was the same officer who had driven Glenn home after he was charged with impaired driving. Glenn thought it funny that his daughter was staying in his home. On the Saturday, Glenn had to work from noon to 6. I drove him to the station. I leaned over and kissed him goodbye. I never felt so dishonest in my life, yet I was really kissing him goodbye. My eyes didn't leave him until the door of the station closed behind him. Then I drove to the Kmart and picked up a set of luggage on sale. I had 6 hours to pack and leave. My heart was wrenched into some terribly twisted, heavy lump. After I left the Kmart, I dropped the luggage at the house. I drove the car to the Shell station to be serviced and walked home. If anything went wrong with the car, I'd be stuck, so I asked the mechanic to check everything. The movers arrived at 1:30 and moved the large pieces out while I packed my clothes, unfinished knitting, records, and photographs. Sarah packed her stuffed animals and makeup. The mover bought her a small stereo for $100. I only took what was mine. We had two beds, but I had to leave them both behind. I couldn't ask the movers to take the second-story windows out. That's how we got the beds in. I left the good pots for Glenn. He did all the cooking. The only questionable thing I took was the stereo. I figured it compensated for the cost of the move that he forced me to make. And besides, I knew I was going to be broke for quite a while. By 4:30, Everything was packed and the truck pulled away. It was a huge van. I was paranoid someone would come out and visit while it was parked in front. The agent drove me to the station to pick up the car. He suggested I stay in town and he'd take me to dinner. Eating was the furthest thing from my mind. I slipped away from that one and picked up my car. My only real time of panic was when I couldn't find the cat. Janie can't stand commotion, so she went hiding. I was in tears calling her. Sarah finally found the white Persian hiding in the bushes, and they both got in the car. At 5:30, we pulled out of the driveway and went up Red River Road to the highway. It was about 5:50, and I was nearing the highway when I realized I'd forgotten the road map. It was too late to go back. Toronto is east, I told myself, and stepped on the gas. I settled back in Toronto and faced the difficulty of being poor. Sarah got a job at the kitchen table in the deli section. We stayed with a girlfriend of mine until we found a one-bedroom apartment near Mount Pleasant in Eglinton. The high school for Sarah was 2 blocks away. A single income is not easy in Toronto, but poverty was more appealing than the depravity I left. Here I wasn't lonely. I had my daughter, my old friends, and a new life to begin. Meanwhile, back in Thunder Bay, Sam was living in an apartment by himself and being lonely. He quickly volunteered to move in with Glenn. Now the radio personalities could regale about radio and commiserate on how unappreciative and stupid women were. I knew the G couldn't live alone long, and Sam fell right in with my plans. I felt like a chess master making all the men move. Sam and the G spent many evenings planning to buy a radio station in Hawaii. The owner wanted $100,000, and when it was time to make a serious bid, the big G convinced Sam they could get it by offering just $12,000. The owner didn't see it that way and ceased dealing with them. Glenn imported an old girlfriend from Toronto to join forces with him. Sam felt the squeeze. The bite of ownership and being your own boss still had Sam hooked. He invested some money in a station in Phoenix, Arizona, and got on the caravan again. In the back of his mind, he entertained the idea of kidnapping his kids and hiding out in the States. In mid-1986, Sam wrote me, he was thinking of moving back to Canada if he could get his money out of the station. The other owner was an alcoholic and had been missing for 3 weeks. Sam was getting nervous. I knew from friends in Thunder Bay that he never failed to badmouth me after my abrupt departure. The G never talked about it. Sam took it upon himself to be the spokesperson. In my mind, I forgave him. He didn't know any better. He wasn't capable of understanding. He had a good time when he came to our house. Therefore, it was good for everyone. I wrote back and told Sam he could call me if he was in Toronto. He did, about 6 months later. We met for lunch and talked about old times. He was tired of radio and was going into the hotel business. On this trip, he was researching hotel courses. That fall, he got an apartment in Toronto near York University and enrolled in a 3-month hotel manager course. I introduced him to some of my friends and invited him to gatherings sometimes. He didn't make friends easily, and my friends tolerated him. He was loud and unsophisticated, especially after a beer. When he secured a job with a hotel in January, Sam approached me with a proposition. He confessed he hated living alone and would like to share a place with me. He cleared his throat and promised not to bother me. I was content living alone, but I did need a larger place. Our one-bedroom apartment did not give us room for privacy. When my daughter was approached with the idea, she was sold immediately. We had subsequent meetings to determine areas and conditions. Split the rent down the middle. I buy the food, since he ate out, mostly at McDonald's, and enjoy any prospective lovers elsewhere. Sam thought it best to protect my daughter from our private lives. In the spring, we moved. The arrangement worked out well. The apartment Sam found near Bathurst and Lawrence had 3 bedrooms, one with its own bathroom. Sam got that room, and Sarah and I shared the other bathroom. My privacy remained intact. He worked 4 to 12, and I had the apartment to myself in the evenings. During the Christmas holidays, Sam approached me with another deal. He was very grateful that I had agreed to the apartment sharing. He wanted to take a winter holiday, and as a birthday gift to me, he offered to pay my way too. My parents were going to Florida for 4 months, and we could visit them. I would have chosen a different vacation if I had the money, but this deal had an emotional catch. I was close to my mother, and she would love for me to visit. He had the forethought to mention it to them before they departed. By February, with my birthday looming, I consented. I was tired and needed a holiday. In the midst of a winter storm, we flew to Florida. During the flight, a fellow passenger engaged in conversation with us. He assumed we were married. I let him know we were just married, not just married. It was then that Sam enlightened both of us. He was happy to be on a holiday with me and could think of no one he'd rather be with. I was more disturbed than flattered, but let it pass. Not to worry was part of my vacation plan. In Tampa, we spent a warm evening with my parents, exchanging stories and making plans for the next day, my birthday. My mom and I tried to talk over Sam's loudness. She was interested in how my sisters were doing. I wanted to tell her the version with my opinion included. We both realized our intimate talks would have to wait. At 2 a.m. we said goodnight and drove the rented car to the Hyatt Hotel. Sam was in the hotel business and wanted to experience the best. The room was large and contained 2 double beds. The view looked over the pool and Tampa Bay. We took turns in the bathroom. I came back into the room with my long cotton nightgown and terry cloth robe. Sam sat at the table. He wore his pajamas and a sickly shade of orange robe. It crossed my mind how unattractive he was to me. He poured me a nightcap and invited me to join him at the table. He was a bit high, and I was a lot tired. He cleared his throat and suggested that we could mess around and have some fun while on vacation. The friendship could be resumed back in Toronto. I let him know I didn't need to travel 1,600 miles to do my dirty business. The idea was preposterous, and I wasn't interested. He took rejection easy. Once in our beds, he had the last word. If I changed my mind to let him know, I said good night and went to sleep immediately. The morning after wasn't uncomfortable. We took turns in the bathroom, putting on our summer clothes. After breakfast, we drove back to the Haven Motel and picked up my parents. We spent the next days shopping, sightseeing, and staying up late visiting. I began to relax. I flew to Florida with $5 Canadian in my wallet and spent the $200 allowance Sam gave me. On Wednesday, we left my parents and drove to Fort Lauderdale. Late in the day, we went to see the movie Broadcast News. I was missing my solitude, and it was a break from talking. Sam wanted to know everything about me and didn't understand anything I told him. In the evening, we drove on to Miami and checked into the Hotel Intercontinental. The uniformed doorman immediately took over the car and our luggage and escorted us into the lobby. The desk clerk informed Sam that due to overbooking, we were upgraded to a suite at no extra charge. With key in hand, the bellboy took us up to suite 1104 on the 31st floor. He opened the door and ushered us in. On the left was a small bathroom. I noted the fresh flowers and telephone. Ahead of us was the living room. The decor had a Chinese motif and felt warm and pretty. The windows looked over Biscayne Bay. There was a marble table and 2 chairs near the window. The interior of the room contained a matching sofa and chair, a chest that contained drawers and a television and minibar on the back wall. Hilaire, the bellboy, then led us into the master bathroom. The bathtub and shower were in a separate room. Mirrored closet doors took up one wall. The mirror over the sink was similar to ones found in old movie theaters, where you could see your reflection repeated forever. Again, I noted fresh flowers and a telephone. In the small hallway preceding the bedroom, there was a discreet dresser with an ice bucket, champagne, and bonbons. The bedroom had the same view overlooking the bay and a television. Once again, we had the two double beds separated by a table with overhead lamps and a telephone. Sam asked the bellboy what the standard tip was. For once, I appreciated his naivety. I certainly didn't know the protocol. He gave him $5, and Hilaire said to ask for him if we needed anything. When he closed the door behind him, Sam and I laughed like kids. We agreed it was the best room either of us had ever been in. We sat on the living room couch, sipped champagne, and watched MTV. When hunger beckoned, we called room service. "I could have anything on the menu," Sam said. He ordered a hamburger and fries, and I concurred. Fatigue had narrowed my appetite. I enjoyed playing rich woman of the world and eating junk food. A half hour later, a waiter wheeled in a linen-covered table and retrieved our dinner from the concealed warming box underneath. He lifted the covers and asked if the meal was as we requested. I sniffed the air and said it was fine. We devoured our dinner and washed it down with champagne to the strains of rock videos. When it got late, we went to separate bathrooms and changed for bed. Good nights were quick and smooth. I had a lovely sleep. By 10 o'clock the next morning, we were in the motel restaurant having breakfast. Sam was anxious to get moving and show me Miami. He planned that we would sightsee and shop all day. In the evening, we would dress up and have dinner in the best dining room in the hotel. I agreed, and we went out to the streets of Miami. In the afternoon, we took a bus to Coconut Grove, famous for the Art Deco buildings. We walked through the area looking at everything. I commented to Sam on the different trees, and he called me Mum when answering. I said he really was looking for a mother, and he kept quiet. While waiting for the return bus, he seemed in a hurry to get back, but I wasn't bothered. I was on vacation. Back at the hotel, Sam dressed in a suit, and I put on the new dress I bought. Sam said I looked lovely, and we went downstairs to the dining room. The maitre d' escorted us to a table away from the musician. After bringing drinks, the waiter left us with the menu. I knew there wasn't one item that Sam would enjoy. Seafood and wild game meats were the fare of this room. I ordered the lobster with bean sauce. Sam chose the veal chop. He then went to the bathroom and left me alone for about 5 minutes. I thought he looked a bit pale and hoped he wasn't sick. Sam hated his meal and ate only the roasted potatoes and apples. The waiter offered to bring him anything else on the menu, but Sam said he was full. There wasn't anything else for him on the menu, so he filled up with bread. After dinner, he suggested we take a walk on the waterfront. I felt full and welcomed the stroll. We walked along with our hands in our pockets. There was a cruise boat out on the water. Reggae music wafted through the palm trees. It was a balmy summer evening in February. Sam suggested we sit down. I wished to walk further, but he insisted he wanted to sit. Sam cleared his throat and said he wanted to talk to me. I was instructed to let him finish and not to answer too quickly when he was finished. I took a deep breath and he began his monologue. He told me he liked me from the first day he saw me in Thunder Bay and was jealous of Glenn. He was heartbroken when I moved back to Toronto and thought he'd never see me again. The happiest days of his life were spent when he moved into an apartment with Sarah and I. He loved both of us very much and would like to make life better for us. He was considering buying a house in the fall for all of us to live in. I could have the ballet studio I always wanted and a nice home. He would take care of my debts, and he didn't need the money I earned. To put out the money for a house was not a problem, but he needed a commitment from me. He wanted to know that we would live there for a long time. He knew I didn't love him, but it didn't matter to him. My happiness was the most important thing to him, and he wanted to provide me with the things I deserved. He produced a small ring box and told me he had a ring made for me. It was a diamond with a gold band, and he had it made especially for me. He wished to marry me, and he wanted me to take the ring and think about it. I had 6 months to consider his offer. If my answer was no, I couldn't keep the ring, but please not to answer right away. We could have an open-concept marriage. I suppressed my eyebrows from raising. I could fool around all I wanted as long as I didn't flaunt it. I could do anything as long as I didn't talk about it. But he needed a commitment from me. When it was my turn, I chose my words carefully. I had no desire to be married. My goals were career-oriented. I really couldn't accept the ring because I did not want to spend the next 6 months considering a wedding. I wanted to take university courses and get a better job. I was happy not being in love. It was a delicious freedom. He was disappointed, but gave me the option of changing my mind. We walked back to the hotel bar. I wanted a drink. Old Beatle music played, and I enjoyed my teen memories. I knew all the words to the songs. Things we said today took on new meaning. Sam interrupted my reverie and reminded me I wasn't getting any younger and should seriously consider his offer. The offer was better than what his wife ever received. He then brought up the big G and wanted to know if I still wanted him back. I reminded him it was I who ended the relationship and was happy with my life alone. He said if I wasn't dating someone, there was something wrong with me. Didn't I ever get emotional about anyone? He meant horny, but was being polite. With his marriage offer, I would have no money problems and could have anyone I wanted. He would want a piece of the action, too, but it was all right if I went home with someone else I fancied. He suggested it was healthy to mess around. It only took 15 minutes and could make people more relaxed. He wanted only me, but if I didn't love him, I could still enjoy others. What an offer to make to one's future bride, I thought. At midnight, we went back to the suite. Sam was exhausted and went directly to bed. I sat by the window with a magazine. Because I was in Miami, I had to look at the bay from indoors. Because I was with Sam, I still couldn't be alone.
That was Martha McLaughlin reading her story, Radio Caravan. That concludes Life Rattle number 1201. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman recorded Martha reading her story. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Sunday night at 9 to hear more Life Rattle classics, 2 more stories from Martha McLaughlin, and 2 stories by Kathy Barney.